WGXC underwriting support is provided by the Healthcare Consortium, a rural health network dedicated to improving access to healthcare and supporting the health and well-being of the people in our rural community. Throughout 2018, the Healthcare Consortium will be celebrating 20 years of serving the residents of Columbia and Greene counties. To learn more about the Healthcare Consortium and its services, please visit www.columbiahealthnet.org or call 518-822-8820.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guest this month is Dan Weldon, who is currently showing his prints, photographs, and paintings at BCB Art in Hudson. Mr. Weldon is a master printmaker who has collaborated with such artists as Willem de Kooning, Robert Rauschenberg, Jim Dine, Van Flaven, and Kiki Smith. After the interview, Soo Yeon Kim, piano prodigy, age 23, playing Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I am here at BCB Art with Dan Weldon. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Richard.
So, you're showing prints and paintings here this month?
Prints, paintings, and photographs.
And photographs.
Yeah, so something I really... not done before, because I really like coming across with the idea that I know what I'm doing. And in this particular case, I do know what I'm doing, but I also decided to change my approach on things, and maybe because I started doing all these other activities. Not that photography is new to me or paintings are new to me, but I've been concentrating with printmaking for so long that people identified the printmaking with the name as synonymous. And so when people saw paintings, they would say, oh, you know how to paint? And so that's what seemed to... And I said, oh, I kind of like that, surprising people that I know how to do something else too.
You're considered a master printer, I guess you would say, right?
Yeah.
And you print for a lot of other artists.
Yeah, that title is something that I've gotten, but it's not something I really... I don't like the word master so much because it implies that you know it all, and I really rather not have that sense. I'd rather learn and continue learning, be more of a student of art. Well, since the early 70s, when I came back into this country, I started working for a woman named Tanya Grossman, and had the privilege of working with Rauschenberg and Larry Rivers, Jasper Johns, Motherwell, Rauschenberg, Saul Steinberg, a host of people. The first artist I printed was Jim Dine, and, you know, big 5-foot lithographs. And then I was simultaneously opening up my own studio, and I started working with artists on my own. And then that seemed to grow and grow. But I made a very hard and steadfast promise to never get absorbed in the money factor and the business of making prints for other artists, because I had to not lose sight of my own work, my own goals and aspirations to being an artist. So I promised not to continue doing that on a regular full-time basis. I would do one of my works in between everybody else's.
And you always painted as well as the...
No, I didn't. That was the whole thing. I stopped painting completely, and I just did prints. One day, a woman, Ruth Baird, was as a gallery owner, dealer on the East End of Long Island. She said, "I'd like to show your paintings." I said, "Well, I don't do paintings. I just do prints." She said, "Dan, I want to show your canvases." I said, "Well, I work on paper." And she said, "You didn't hear me. I want to show your canvas." I said, "No, you didn't hear me. This is what I do." I was very kind of obstinate about it. And she said, "Listen, dummy, paint on canvas. It'll sell for more." You know, just like that. She was an Israeli, and she's still a friend. She's Israeli and very direct. And I appreciate her so much for that directness, because she opened me up, and my door was pretty closed at the time. I mean, I was still printing for other artists and developed a little bit of a reputation as the master printer on Eastern Long Island. So I was working with de Kooning and with Dan Flavin, and later on with other artists that I started really in this other process. And that was Eric Fischel, being a really major person. He was very important in that development. What I would actually do is I never really truly stopped, but I started taking my rejected prints and painting over them, because the paper was good and it had something to say, but it didn't quite make it as a print. So I would take my gesso or crayons and work over them, and it would become a painting or a one-of-a-kind work on paper. So it had a print base. The print sometimes crept through, and one could see the remnants of the ghost of a print underneath the painting, and which didn't bother me at all. I liked that sense of working on something of my own, as opposed to a stark white piece of paper that had no history to it. So,
you have one of those pieces in this show, I think.
Yes, Green Ribbon. Yeah.
And when you paint, you use oils?
I use anything. I'm not particular about one thing over another. It's really what works. I mean, I like acrylics because of fast drying. I like using layers and layers because it allows me to do several pieces at the same time. So sometimes I'll have 5 or 7 works going on. While one is drying, I'll work on another. And when I'm on a roll, it just feels good. It feels good to have a lot of things happening.
And at this point, are you still printing for other people?
A little bit. I was just with Kiki Smith this morning. We printed back a while, this last winter, in Wisconsin. We did some proofing, and she wound up finishing it up there. And I didn't complete the project, but I was on the ground floor when the piece was conceived with her and helped her develop the plates for it. And actually, that's what I like doing most. Printing the edition tends to be a little bit more monotonous, and whereas doing those first impressions and those first explorations and collaborations is, to me, very exciting.
And so the way it works is you're actually working with the artist to say what will work?
Sort of a guide, sometimes a bit of a teacher, sometimes a facilitator, sometimes just a sounding board. Working with de Kooning one time was interesting because he was working on a lithographic stone we had there, and he was drawing away, and he kept his eyes on the stone, and he started talking. I was behind him, and it didn't matter that it was me. It just that he was talking, and he says, "Oh, I think that's enough." And I responded, and I said, "I think you put a little bit more in there." And it didn't matter that it was me. It could have been a three-year-old. But he needed to sound off to someone, and I happened to be that person.
And you had a story when you gave a little gallery talk last week about carrying a giant lithography stone up to the beach with Dan Flavin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Dan Flavin was a stickler. I mean, he had to have a certain thing, a certain way, at a certain time, and that was all there was to it. And I liked him. I liked him very much in working with him because he was clear. He was clear about what he wanted. He didn't mince words. And it wasn't like some other artists that didn't know what they were doing. He was conceptual. So that clarity came out one day, and he said, "Oh, let's go to the beach." And so my good friend Roy Nicholson and I, we wheeled this 300-pound stone out to the beach in the sand on a little cart with tiny wheels and pushed this thing while he was standing there with his New York Giants baseball cap on. And he told me where to put the stone, and he started drawing away. And it was really an amazing experience watching him. He warmed up with gestural drawings, and I at first thought, "Oh, what's he going to draw here?" And I was nauseated with the idea that he was going to draw sailboats, because that's as boring as a sunset on Long Island, you know, just that, or another lighthouse with a seagull, you know. So I said, "Oh, no, what's he going to do that for?" But my surprise was the beauty of his work and how he caught the gesture of those, and within 20 seconds, 30-second drawing, so beautiful. And he knew what he was doing. He knew how to draw. And he had that ability to make decisions and such clarity, real clarity. He was probably the most difficult artist I ever worked with, I would think. But the works turned out good. They really turned out nice.
You're German born?
No, I'm born here. My parents were German. And a pretty long history of my father's side is actually, the name is von Welden, and we have 13 castles over the years, and my grandfather was born in a castle. And so I was just telling the story about how I went and visited some of these places, and it was so interesting because there were people who greeted me knowing the name. And it was a 72-year-old man who greeted me, and I was, 20-something years old. And he greeted me by clicking his heels and bowing down. And he said, "Herr Baron," you know, and tears came out of his eyes when he greeted me because I was the first Welden that he saw since 1912. Huh. And he happened to carry the processional cross for this, he called him Uncle Max, Maximilian von Welden, who was a relative, but a good man, and left him with an impression. So when I was that first relative that he hadn't seen since 1912, it was very emotional for him, and I was very touched by his warmth. And I said, "He must have been a nice guy, this Maximilian." My grandson is Maximilian Nikolai Welden. He lives in Rosendale.
Now, in terms of subject matter, do you have any particular interest?
I've always been a series painter, working one piece after another to complete a series of work. Sometimes a series would go 3 years and then, or 10 years and another 10 years. I don't start with the intention of knowing how long or anything. I just work. And the longer I work on something, the more it evolves or I develop a deeper commitment to that subject, whatever it is. The first series I did was influenced by a Norwegian landscape, Actually, the day after Elvis Presley died, I was high on a mountaintop, and I saw some incredible view below. I was all alone, and it was pouring rain. I was eating blueberries and felt, tasted, saw, smelled, and heard every all the senses kicked in at the same moment. I said, "Wow." It was so incredible. I said, I got to do this. I've got to continue with it. It was the first time I was able to commit to anything for over a period of time. Before that, I was just doing whatever came along, whether it was landscape or abstract or portrait or, you know, and then this particular theme came along, and I said, this is something I felt. I felt the need to continue it. And that three-year series led to another one that lasted about 10 years when I was digging in my backyard, and I came across an old rusty license plate from 1939 New York World's Fair. And this tattered license plate was so beautiful. It was all rusty, and I said, picked it up in my hands, and I looked at it, and I said, I could print that, and I can make an impression from that. So I started making impressions from these old license plates and mud flaps and logos and change them so they really wouldn't be that readable and they would be part of a composition. I think I was working with Rauschenberg at the time too, and so I had to have a little bit of a rub off from his pop art series and what he was about. And I liked that man very much. He was a real terrific man. Great.
These artists all pretty much had studios out in Long Island, I guess.
Well, I don't know about all of them. When I worked with Tanya Grossman, I didn't get to their studios, but when I worked with de Kooning and Flavin, and the last artist that I worked with was Jack Youngerman. And Jack is 91 now, 91, 92 maybe. And real gentleman and more of a sculptor than anything else, I would say. But we found a way to make prints, and we had a good time this last winter. We did, first we did 10 small black and white, well, they were about 8 by 8 inches. And then after that, we did a larger piece, a three color piece, and about 12 inches square.
In this show, you have a series of yoga poses,
yeah,
which you said you did those quite quickly also.
They were the fastest works I think I've ever done in my life. I was very inspired by a beautiful woman in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and she was truly beautiful in every way. And she came into the room where I was working, looking to pose for an art class. And I said, well, there's no class going on. But if you would like to work for me for an hour or so, maybe we can come up with something. But not today. So she came back on Friday morning, 9 o'clock, and by then I get myself all set up. And I did, and she being a yoga, a Pilates teacher, and a dancer, was capable of putting her body into a pretzel shape and all kinds of beautiful poses. And she would hold them for maybe 10, 15, 20 seconds. And that would give me the opportunity to kind of get a gesture. And I did the series of trace monotypes, which wound up being 72 drawings within the hour. I put an ink, it was called a trace monotype, where I put a slab of ink down on a piece of glass and then put a piece of paper on top of it and then drew on the back side of the paper or the front side, and then the back side would, from the pressure of the pencil, lift up the image. And that was very much like a carbon paper, except it had the trace monotype gives you more accidental and, kind of fuzzy. I guess the term that in today's world would be noise, with looking at the computer, lots of things that are unwanted, but they're wanted when you're doing that process. So they're kind of nice effect. It's not as pure as a drawing. It's more than a pure drawing. Getting the backwards effect, because if you're drawing on one side, you look at the back side of the paper, and it's the exact opposite. So it's as though you're working with the other side of your brain almost when you look at that. Or a mirror image in a way. In a way, I feel very proud of these 72 drawings. Well, of the 72, there's only 33 that I liked. And those 33 works, I look at them and I say, I tell people, I didn't do them. Because it's the backside of what I did. It's the other side is what I really did. And it's sort of confusing to people when they hear that because they don't understand it. But anybody that would imagine looking at the backside of a piece of paper, if they were able to draw right through it, that's what they would be looking at. And that's what the surprise element is. The surprise is really what's kind of nice to me, the unknown, the unanticipated. I mean, anybody can think something out, but not everybody has the openness to explore and experiment and say, okay, let's work with what comes along. And that's what I like doing. You know, I like working with accidents, too.
And now a painting, on the other hand, you may work for a long period.
Now, that's a whole other thing. When I started getting more serious about painting, I was struggling with one painting for about 4 years. I couldn't get it to work. It was a 7-foot canvas. And I'd start it and then wind up painting over it, paint again, and I just kept on painting over it. I was very unhappy with everything I did on it. And then one day I said, all right, I'm going to get on this and I'm going to discipline myself to try to get more on it this time. And somehow or other, the canvas and the brush and the pigment, it all spoke and it all came together. My mind, it became together. It became one with the canvas and it clicked. And in unbelievable time, the painting came together. So it took 4 years to get to that one point where it all worked. So, and then I did another pretty good-sized one after that, and I said, boy, this painting is easy, this painting stuff, as opposed to, it's so much easier. And then I was fooled again because I worked on a little one that was maybe 36 inches, 40 inches, which I struggled over again. So it's not always predictable, and I have to be careful if I say something like, oh, this is easy, because that's... It humbles me very quickly.
Now, as far as the photography, what is that?
The photography, that was sort of I used to do photography. I was a little bit of a commercial photographer. I had a little business and all. I did some fine art photography. But then one day I was out in the woods in the Catskills, deep in a spruce forest, and the snow had really, really come down. I couldn't get over the beauty. You could hardly walk through this forest because in a spruce forest where the trees are close together, all the branches are ready to, you have to walk in between branches without getting snow down your neck. And so I was doing that and I just stopped and I said, wow, look at these, this is such an incredible network of snow and branch and black and white. Everything was black and white, no color. And I had my cell phone with me, and I said, I'm going to take a series of pictures. So I took 13 pictures, and I made 13 works. And that was the snow series. Once I made the works, then I made the solar plate etchings from them. Solar plate. That's the process. If they're actually photo etchings, I made a plate based upon a photograph. And then, in other words, the photographic image is made into a transparent film. At Staples, you take the image and send them the file. And they made this nice transparency for me for each of the photographs. And I would take that transparent film, put it in contact with the solar plate, which is a light-sensitive plate, expose it and develop it in water, and I'd have an etching. All right, so once that etching plate was made, then I'd apply ink to it and then put it on my press, put a piece of paper on top of it, crank it through, peel it off, and I'd have a black and white image of that snow and that forest. And so it gave me a lot of pleasure to come up with 13 new images that were really unrelated to my paintings and unrelated to my prints. They were new. And they were quite exciting. And then I decided to watercolor them. And that's what I wound up changing the black and white to a little bit of color. It's a real... And this morning I was talking with Kiki Smith, and she really enjoyed them quite a bit. And she encouraged me very much to continue along that series. So I just might do that, might follow her advice and see what happens this winter. I have to wait for the snow.
She seems to be a person who does a lot of experimenting herself.
And how. And she's so open. She's a lovely person, yeah. So we have the show going on now with the print, with the paintings and the prints and the photographs that Bruce, who's a very long-time friend, I've known Bruce since he was a kid, probably from 1972 to 75, and on Long Island. And so he's been a very supportive person, a really wonderful person. This is my second solo show with him. Oh, it just gives me such pleasure, and I'm proud of him. I'm really so proud because of what he's done with this gallery and making a place for himself in the art world. Last week when I was at the Omega Institute, and there were quite a number of people from the class that I taught there that came up for the little gallery talk. And they had some nice questions, along with some other people that were in the community that came.
So what were you actually teaching at the Omega Institute?
I was teaching a class called Impressions to Remember, and then a second class called Journey to the Unknown. So both of those dealt with a printmaking, an episode in printmaking where people would go on a journey. It's a very different place for me to teach because I don't have to evaluate people. I don't have to tell people. They're there to have an enjoyable experience. And that is really what I look at, as opposed to some other places where I have to sort of teach with more discipline in mind so that they can learn everything. This is more of a class where they can meditate, they can appreciate music and poetry, and do art, but all through doing art through printmaking. And when we're doing art through printmaking, I like to say we're learning more about life. And so we get into lots of other discussions, philosophical discussions, and especially with poetry.
How did you happen to get affiliated with them?
That's a good question. I went to the Omega Institute to participate in workshops, and I liked it so much. I said, gee, this is such a... I wonder if I could ever teach here. So I made an inquiry, and I didn't really hear anything about it. And then one day I was there, and then I happened to find out that the executive director was a former student of mine. A high school student, Lois Guarino was her name. And Lois and I, thank goodness she remembered me, because I remembered her vividly, and she was always a talented person. And we talked and talked, and what do you do? And I said something like, you know, what would it take to teach here? And you know, so she introduced me to someone who said, okay, send us some information. And I guess they liked it. Now it's been 6 years, and every year, they come up and do a little workshop, and we had 30 people this year, so it was really maybe a little bit more, but it was a nice group of people. Not one prima donna. Everybody was wonderful.
So, and how long does the course go on?
One was a weekend class, and the other was a 5-day class. But when you say 5 days, that doesn't include nights. They worked till midnight some days, so they really were so enthusiastic. We got some good works done. I'd go back there. Actually, I'm going back there at the end of the month to do a residency. And a residency is my most favorite thing to do because I get out of my own studio, out of my own house, away from my computer, and away from interruptions. So at the Omega Institute, they're giving me a place to live, and I can eat the food there, and I can do Qigong, Chai Chi in the morning, and yoga in the afternoon, feel good mentally, physically, and spiritually. So, and meet some wonderful people. Walk around Omega, and people look you in the eye, and they greet you, and there's a smile on their face, and it's a great, great place. I love it there.
Have you been doing yoga and that sort of thing for a long time, Tai Chi?
Only at Omega have I been doing the Qigong, because I don't know enough to do it on my own. Yoga I do a little bit more because it's a little bit more available, but I'd like to do more Tai Chi. I'd like to get something going. At my home in Long Island, I built a separate building with a gallery below and a barefoot room on top. And that barefoot room is about 24 by 32 feet, and it's all wooden arches and nice wooden floor. And it's a really great yoga room. And we do all kinds of activities up there with drum circles and different types of healing activities, and yoga especially. But I'd like to get some Tai Chi or Qigong going up there too.
And you've lived out there for quite a while, huh?
I bought a piece of land in 1980-81, and I lived in the Hamptons for 14 years before starting to build. I lived for 14 years without running water in my life. And I was trying to save my pennies and figure out how I could save enough money to get a bite on a building. And I did a lot of the work myself, and I built a home. And with lots of wood, stone, glass, and it's a great space. It's a very unique structure.
And you're actually outside the village of Sag Harbor.
Yeah, I'm in the woods. You can't see another house. It's really nice. It's kind of very isolated. I can hear my next door neighbor's tennis ball, but I can't see anything. It's a nice environment, close to the beach. I don't go to the beach much during the summer times. Too many people. I like wintertime activities more out there, outdoor winter. I have a wood stove that I heat the house with. I use about 5-6 cords of wood a year. I burn a lot. And that's the primary heat source in the house. I like chopping wood. It's a good exercise. So if I can't do Tai Chi, I'll chop wood.
And you have taught in academic situations.
I did. I taught at Stony Brook University. I was a full-time professor there for 8 years. And then I went to Central Connecticut State University and had a wonderful time there for 2 years. And that was the end of my full-time teaching career. Central Connecticut was really nice, but it was a temporary appointment. And it was a 5-hour commute to Sag Harbor.
So, you take the ferry across?
I did. I took the ferry. Well, sometimes I would drive around. That would take 5 hours. But it was the way it was. And it was the highest paying job I ever had in my life. And it paid $29,000 for the year. But occasionally I would be able to sell a piece of artwork or something. One time coming back from New Britain, Connecticut on I-95, I had a Volkswagen Rabbit, and I had 6 paintings strapped to the roof. And 3 of them were finished paintings, and 3 of them were virgin white canvases ready to paint. And if you know I-95, it's not a nice road. It's big tractor-trailer trucks and gusts of wind and everything like that. Well, sure enough, one of those gusts of wind took all 6 canvases, and they flew off. I pulled off on the grass seeing if I could rescue something, but it would have been instant death if I walked out there because the paintings were immediately shredded. Shredded, I mean, like, but the 3 virgin canvases fell off on the grass, unharmed. And I held on to the side of the car because, and I said, oh, I can paint. And that was my response. And I said, okay, you know, the others were done for, you know. I was looking for collage material and nothing, you know, just totally done. No photographic record, $10,000 worth of work down the drain in 3 seconds, you know. Well, yeah, that was an experience. It was a good experience because it allowed me to let go. It allowed me to realize that it's not important. It allowed me to realize that the most important part of making art is the act, the doing of it, as opposed to the end product. So, and I still believe that the act of the doing is really where it's at. So I'm also writing a second book. It's on printmaking again, and it's going to be on the process of solar plate. And I hope by the end of the year that should be finished and out there. The topic is the process involving light-sensitive polymer film or light-sensitive polymer plates that I'm exposing with the sun. And that process is called solar plate. And how it's done, who it's being done by, and lots of pictures and explanations on how to do it.
And that makes a photographic.
It could be photographic. It could be just. It could be a drawing or a painterly approach. It's something I like to say. I don't like to use it as a reproductive medium. It's very easy to fall into reproduction with this, but to me, that's a no-no. That becomes something else. I like the sense of preaching originality and intent through your idea and an execution, as opposed to taking something that pre-exists. If you take something that's out there and you do something that's the same, it's a copy. It's not an original. Whereas if you conceive of something that's new, even if it's a photograph, you go out with the photograph in mind of making the plate, then it's a new and it's an original work. It's hard to get through to some people that want to do something that they've done that they feel successful about. And it's not that it's wrong, it's just not doesn't have the same integrity as doing an original work with intent. Oh, I also like it here. I like being in the Hudson River Valley. I've always been torn between the seaside and the mountains. I have a place in the Catskills, in the woods. I have no electricity or running water, just a little shack in the hills on bordering state land. And it's really a very favorite retreat place for me. Nobody could get a hold of me. There's no reception for anything. So I'm totally without and with everything. Without conveniences and with everything that the world has, it's beautiful to me. It's a real respite.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure working with you. It's a pleasure being here.